It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In December, Scott Brady will mark 2 years as the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. Among other things, he's worked with international law enforcement partners to take down a large malware conspiracy network and go after cyber criminals, crack down on physicians illegally prescribing painkillers, and his office is prosecuting the suspected gunman in the Tree of Life mass killings last October. Now he's been named to an advisory committee for U.S. Attorney General William Barr. Scott Brady, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. It's good to be here.
You and eight other U.S. attorneys from across the country were appointed to this advisory group serving the Trump administration. What will be your role individually?
Well, first, it's a great honor to be named by the Attorney General. The advisory committee really does play an important role in shaping DOJ policy. So it's not an honorific title or appointment. It's not something that you just kind of mail in and they talk about. But we meet in Washington with the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General every other month, bi-monthly. Mm-hmm. And we will have meetings with the heads of all of the federal law enforcement agencies. And then we also have a role in leading subcommittees that are discipline-based. So there are cyber committees, there are opioid committees, white-collar crime committees. And in those leadership positions, that's where we really have a chance to have an impact on DOJ policy nationally.
Mm-hmm. So what about you? Is there a specific specialty that you're involved with?
Well, I have been a part of both the opioid and the cyber committees thus far in my first 2 years. Right. And again, they reflect my interest in those and my leadership in those reflects what we are doing on the ground here and what Western Pennsylvanians are facing. I think I will continue that and hopefully have a bigger leadership role in that. There are some things, as you're aware, Kevin, and your listeners are aware, that we are doing here in Pittsburgh, especially in the cyberspace, and frankly, in response to the opioid epidemic and successes that we're seeing, that other districts can learn from us and that we can have an impact nationally. I think one specific area that in the near term I want to help lead is our response to domestic violence. And we were, several U.S. attorneys have been talking about domestic violence and our federal response and what that could look like. And so we formed a working group with the Attorney General's blessing a few months ago, and I was named to the Attorney General's working group on domestic violence.
I thought maybe this would be more localized, the domestic violence issue, to local law enforcement, the county district attorneys.
It absolutely is. And we're not trying to federalize a local or state problem or step on anyone's toes or jurisdiction. I think for us, as we look at the intersection of domestic violence and firearms violence, we're trying to find that inflection point where we can surge resources, where we have specific jurisdiction authorized by Congress, and make a real meaningful impact. It's not to plant a flag. It's not to just, again, give lip service to a national problem, but it's to have a real impact that, you know, keep women in Western Pennsylvania safe. Mm-hmm. So specifically, the areas that we have jurisdiction are in firearms. If you are subject to a current PFA, protection from mm-hmm. abuse order, or you have a domestic violence conviction and you own a firearm, that's illegal under federal law. And so you can be convicted for the illegal possession of a firearm. I think there's a space there we can have real impact. And the other space is in cyber. When we can marry our cyber capabilities here that, again, lead the nation to the problems that people are seeing on college campuses and, frankly, in the general population, from sextortion to revenge porn to cyber stalking, real issues where they cross state lines and they're really outside of the resource capacity of local law enforcement, we can add value there and have a real impact.
Realizing that policy is decided at the top, at the Attorney General's office, how many of the components, if you would, of the overall policy can percolate up from the district level, from your office?
Well, we see two dynamics at play. One is the broad policy initiatives are driven by Maine Justice and by the Attorney General himself. And he paints those, or she, in the case of Loretta Lynch, paint those in broad brushstrokes and then allow the U.S. attorney community to really contextualize them to an individual locality. Because, again, with the Catholic principle of subsidiarity, we are in the best position to understand how to best combat a given epidemic, given the limited resources we have. So we are empowered to, with great discretion, to make those decisions and effectuate those priorities. The reverse, then, is that when we have been successful in certain spaces or when we are seeing new trends, we share that information among U.S. attorneys, our colleagues. We speak regularly, formally, and informally, and then drive that conversation up to main justice when we think it's important for them to know, for the policymakers to understand what's actually happening on the ground.
When you were on the Confluence last year, you talked about the priorities for the Western District. Have they changed much or even at all?
Well, certainly the Tree of Life brought the issue of homegrown violent extremists into stark relief and the rise of white supremacism and domestic terrorism broadly. That was always on our radar screen. Domestic and international terrorism is always our top priority. The priorities that we talked about last year were the opioid epidemic. Again, we have seen success in through aggressive prosecution and very intentional and ongoing engagement with the medical and treatment community. We saw a 40% decrease in overdose deaths in 2018. A lot of reasons for that, some of which I think we can take credit for. But again, that's a testament to a broad concern and engagement by law enforcement, the medical community, and the treatment community. Anti-violence was a priority of General Sessions and General Barr. So we, through our Project Safe Neighborhood initiative and focusing on firearm violence, attempting to identify and prosecute the most violent people that are terrorizing communities, have been successful. Our prosecutions are up. And as a result, we have seen for firearms-related violence a decrease of 25% in Allegheny County and 32% in Pittsburgh across the entire district, 19% for, again, all metrics of firearms-related violence.
How much do law enforcement goals vary from district to district, from U.S. attorney to U.S. attorney?
We really see how these problems are localized, and the response really does vary from district to district. And just as an example, I was in Baltimore earlier this week for a regional OCDEF conference. OCDEF is Organized Crime and Drug Enforcement Task Force, and that's the main vehicle through which the department and our federal partners engage both law and organized crime and international drug trafficking, including cartel activity in the United States. And so there were seven U.S. attorneys' offices represented there and all the heads of all the federal agencies. And it was fascinating because what we see in Western Pennsylvania with still a huge fentanyl problem in the Southwest and a growing meth problem in the northwestern part of this district, which some term as the fourth wave of the opioid epidemic, that is not uniformly seen in some of the other districts. So you have more rural districts represented, like the Western District of Virginia, both districts of West Virginia, which are fighting both MS-13, which we haven't seen here in Western Pennsylvania yet, and widespread methamphetamine problem. But in the urban areas on the East Coast, whether DC or Baltimore or Philadelphia, they are still fighting a lot of gang violence, a lot of cartel-driven and MS-13-driven drug trafficking and violence. So it really varies, and that's why the informal information sharing among all of the stakeholders in this is critically important to a successful response.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, Scott Brady. Scott, you mentioned earlier the Tree of Life shooting. We're near the one-year mark. Where are you in the court process in the prosecution?
Well, and what is public and what I can speak about is the Attorney General authorized the department to seek the death penalty in that case. It was a death penalty eligible case given the charges and the fatalities, as everyone is aware. That was filed, and then the court is now proceeding through some discovery disputes is perhaps overstated. We actually are working closely with the defense attorneys in this to make sure that the information they have a right to see is given to them in a timely way. Mm-hmm. And it is before Judge Ambrose, a very experienced district court judge, former chief judge of the Western District. She is making sure that the case is proceeding in a way that protects the equities of both the public and the public interest that the department is vindicating and of the defendant himself and making sure they're receiving the discovery information in a timely way.
Does the death penalty complicate the prosecution for your office, or is that just in the penalty phase if there's a conviction?
It really is in the penalty phase. So you will have in the trial, you'll have a guilt phase and a penalty phase. Juries will hear both of those and will vote on those. So they certainly blend together, but it is somewhat bifurcated at the trial stage. And again, we're not quite at the trial stage yet.
You mentioned Judge Donetta Ambrose. Do you have a goal, a timeline, an expectation of when the case will go to trial?
It will likely go to trial in 2020. I don't want to hazard a guess because, of course, there are a lot of things that have to happen between then and now. I think everyone is interested in seeing justice effectuated in a way, again, that serves the interest of the public and of the Jewish community and the victim community.
How difficult is this case for your office? Not so much in preparation, but in the nature of the crime itself.
Well, this is obviously a tragedy. It was a national tragedy and an international tragedy. A lot of attention has rightly been brought to not only this case, but the issue of extremism and racism, anti-Semitism specifically, and rightly so. Our job is to roll up our sleeves and work as hard as we can to make sure that the interests of both the broader public in Western Pennsylvania and the victim community and the Jewish community are realized. And so we're going to work hard every day. So in that sense, we're professionals and we have our best prosecutors and investigators on this case, and they're working as hard as they can.
You're professionals, but you're also humans. I'm sure, I assume there's some emotion involved, or do you have to pull that out?
Well, as professionals with a job to do, while certainly all of us involved in this are human and have been touched by this tragedy in different ways, the people that we have on this case have done capital cases before, are among our most experienced prosecutors. I would put them up against prosecutors in any part of DOJ nationally. They're outstanding people, and they will make sure that this case is done well, and which honors the memory of the victims.
Scott Brady is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. More goods are being shipped across the country every day, and Pennsylvania sees some of the most freight delivered by trucks, and it's taking a toll on local infrastructure. Plus, what should mass transit look like around Pittsburgh in 20 years? The Port Authority is working on a new mobile app to modernize things like paying, customer service, and scheduling. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall and Museum opens in 1910. It was designed by a group of Civil War servicemen in the 1890s who enlisted architect Henry Hornbostel to create the Beaux-Arts structure. The Oakland building remains the largest memorial in the country dedicated to military veterans. It served as host for famous visitors, including Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and Nelson Mandela, and has a museum that honors more than 700 named veterans, plus artifacts from most major U.S. conflicts since the Civil War. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 7th, 2019.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Project is a Northside nonprofit educating young people in various trades, while also helping them forge the life skills needed both in and outside of work. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports on the organization that aims to turn local youth into well-rounded citizens.
One of the things that we've discovered is that helping kids decide to be lifelong learners means that they need to be engaged.
At the end of every school day, students are transported to the Pittsburgh Project, located in the Perry Hilltop section of the North Side, where they take part in educational programs. Executive Director Wayne Younger says the Pittsburgh Project partners with local schools to offer enrichment activities by offering academic help, as well as invest in their social well-being.
And help them also grow into creatives who can discover what their passions are and have kind of a vision for their futures.
Over its 34 years of existence, the Pittsburgh Project has engaged students from kindergarten through their senior year in high school with a myriad of programs. They encourage education and team building both after school and throughout the summer, offering space to mold the minds of young people, one of which is
our Dream Lab, which is a creative space where they have the opportunity to explore making whatever they like. Some kids are into fashion, so we have sewing machines where they get a chance to learn how to make clothes. Some are into computers. So the thing that we are hoping to do is inspire our kids to be creators and not just consumers.
Younger says both volunteer and paid teachers are on hand daily,
whose job really is to engage them, keep them in learning mode even after school is done, through engaging their creative processes.
It's been a big part of the fabric of the community.
Joanna Deming says outside of academic enrichment, the Pittsburgh Project created and spearheaded Ballfield Farm.
It's a neighborhood garden where you can get organic produce and learn how to garden alongside your neighbors. So it's a really neat neighborhood asset.
The interaction of students and community members coupled with the skills learned in programming is what she says will help the North Side be both close-knit and sustainable for generations.
We really want to develop our community in a way that our neighbors benefit. It's important that the youth are engaged in every aspect of that development.
Staffer Gabriel Ackman says part of the goal of engaging students is to lead by example, especially if activities take place off the premises.
For example, middle school does service trips during the summer with our summer camp. And so if we go to clean up a garden, or if we go to pick up, you know, cigarette butts downtown, I'm there with them and I'm doing it and I'm showing them, you know, I'm saying, I'm doing this too. Like, I'm in the weeds too with you.
Wayne Younger stresses the importance of making sure all students, especially those from urban communities, have the same opportunities to grow as those from more affluent areas.
We have been helping kids understand that they are leaders. And so being a leader means that they can actually have control over their environment.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More goods and more expensive goods are shipped through Pennsylvania than almost anywhere else in the nation. And a new report by the transportation research nonprofit TRIP shows it's taking a toll on local infrastructure. TRIP Research and Policy Director Rocky Moretti tells The Confluence's Megan Harris that Pennsylvania ranked fifth in the nation in the value of freight delivered by trucks.
How important of a measure is that value? What does that tell you?
Just how very reliant we are on moving goods in and out of the state, and that reliance is increasing. It's partly due to consumers. We want things faster. We want them quicker. Businesses, manufacturers, distribution businesses are even becoming more critical and more demanding. You look at Amazon or large grocers, they're all very reliant on fast and efficient movement of goods, but we're also starting to recognize that our infrastructure isn't really adequate to support it. We've got in Pennsylvania, 1 out of 5 bridges are deficient, 1 out of 3 roads are in poor condition, and we're seeing a huge increase in freight volume in Pennsylvania. That's good for the economy, but it's putting a lot of wear and tear on that system. We're also seeing a significant increase in traffic congestion, and that's also going to slow down the movement of goods in the state.
The challenges with infrastructure, how does that affect the people that are actually doing some of these shipments?
Well, when you look at 1 out of 4 vehicles on rural highways in Pennsylvania and on some of the interstates on I-80 and I-81 and parts of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, it's even higher. You realize how critical that volume of freight moving across the state is to everyone's ongoing life. But it's anticipated that the miles that are heavily congested nationally are going to more than triple over the next 25 years. And then in Pennsylvania, the anticipation is that the value of freight moved in the state is going to increase by 80% and the actual weight of that freight by over 50% in the next 25 years. You see the challenge ahead. We need that freight to be able to move reliably and also safely throughout Pennsylvania. But to do that, you have to infrastructure that's well maintained in some places with additional capacity to accommodate these demands.
Is that all reliant on the economy? The economy is doing well, so we're seeing more freight traffic on the roads?
Well, you're also seeing through automation and consumer demands as well in terms of how quickly we anticipate receiving goods, but also the automation has made freight movement more efficient. We're seeing warehouses operating more efficiently, but all of this is reliant and creating increased demand for freight transportation.
Pennsylvania also ranked fifth in the number of fatal accidents involving large trucks. Is that a causal relationship? Do more trucks on the road logically mean more accidents?
In the last 5 years, we've seen a 20% increase in traffic fatalities involving large combination vehicles, tractor trailers.
Nationwide.
We've seen nationwide. And in Pennsylvania, where on average 162 people are killed annually in crashes involving commercial trucks, there was also a similar increase. This is really just a reflection of more trucks on the road, more cars on the road. And without the improvements in safety features that can make roadways safer, you know, the threat and the concern is we'll see these numbers rise.
What safety features are you looking for? What would make traffic safer for everybody?
Well, starting by having the system in good condition, and that means ongoing investment in major highways, making sure that where guardrails are appropriate, they're there, that there's rumble strips. On rural two-lane roads, which see a lot of fatal truck crashes, paved shoulders, there's a lot of simple, cost-effective roadway improvements that can help improve safety.
But Pennsylvania is not alone in this, are they? It seems like this is something that I hear complaints about nationwide. We're not putting enough in, especially to bridges and bridge safety.
The challenge is funding. The transportation agencies certainly have the expertise to make the improvements, but at the federal level, Congress is debating the next long-term surface transportation bill. It's critical that they put additional funding into it. In Pennsylvania, over the last 6 years, over $4 billion of highway user fees through the state license fund has been diverted, and that's funding that really should be used for transportation improvements.
How is automation changing the game? I've seen reports of automated vehicles, automated big rigs. What does the industry look like now, and where do you see autonomous trucking and rails being used in the future?
The initial impact is on consumer demands and the ability to get goods quicker and demand them quicker, on warehousing and distribution facilities that are much more efficient, and also on freight movements where we're able now in real time to see where there's additional space in the system to move additional freight. Long term, in terms of vehicle autonomy, certainly the more likely scenario long term will be truck platooning, where one truck could lead several other trucks that may not, you know, eventually have drivers in those vehicles. But that would most likely just be in specialized situations, probably on large interstates. Between urban areas, but then drivers individually driving the trucks in a more complex urban environment. But that's still some way off in the future. But again, that is a likely scenario that would further increase the efficiency of truck travel and freight movement. But again, would also put more wear and tear on the system.
Platooning, tell me more about that. Is that how many trucks do you imagine it would be? You know, as a driver of a four-wheeler, what would it look like for you on the interstate next to one of these platoons?
Sure. In terms of numbers, I think that's still to be determined. You know, several trucks, obviously safety is going to be paramount, and that's why I think that's still a number of years in the future And certainly it'll be long after that the safety concerns have been addressed.
Trip cites a report from a consulting firm that recommends a sort of hybrid approach to autonomous trucking. Driverless vehicles would drop off their payload to a truck with an operator partway through the shipping process. Do you think that that's the approach we might see first, as opposed to the fully automated trucking system?
To me, that seems like a more rational approach to this. I think the areas of vehicle autonomy in general still have a lot of challenges to be sorted out. But I think the urban environment is so much more complex that I think that would be far out into the future.
How far in the future do you imagine some of these changes taking place?
Well, you go back to that consultant firm, and they thought platooning initially might be perhaps a decade away. But again, I think this is really going to unfold at a pace that's going to be dictated by the technology and the safety.
Do you see any increased challenge for especially urban centers, maybe further north, where the roads get a little bit more wear and tear because of snow and ice and then salt and brine and that kind of thing?
Certainly, there's a greater challenge for maintaining infrastructure in the north or in any area where you have a freezing and thawing cycles. But that said, engineers, they have the resources available, can keep those systems in good repair. Large combination trucks put significantly more stress on infrastructure. Truckers have in the past and continue to show a willingness to pay their fair share towards maintaining that system. But again, the challenge is at the federal level, having a strong program, and at the state level, making sure that the fees collected from motorists and truckers are then spent on improving roadway infrastructure.
Are you hopeful then that some of these stats can improve, and especially fatalities?
I think if you look at what's happening globally, there's a tremendous recognition of the importance of freight efficiency in terms of supporting a high quality of life and a good economy. And certainly there's been a significant discussion at the national level that the next surface transportation program needs to have a strong component addressing freight transportation needs.
And how close are we to that strong component?
At this point, you know, there's an initial bill at the Senate level. In addition to the Senate, obviously, the House needs to put a bill forward. The current program expires September 30th, 2020. So we're essentially a year away from that program expiring.
So what should replace it?
A long-term surface transportation bill, probably 5 or 6 years, that would have a significant boost in the current level of funding. And then would also have a strong freight program directing resources so that state transportation agencies could use that to address some of their most significant challenges in terms of improving the freight network.
Rocky Moretti is the Director of Research and Policy for Trip. Rocky, thanks so much for taking time.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On Tuesday, the Port Authority of Allegheny County introduced a live chat option for riders with customer service representatives. It's one of the new innovations from the transit agency that will soon include a pay-by-phone app as well as development of a 20-year plan. Joining us now is Catherine Kellerman, CEO of the Port Authority. Catherine, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
In your current budget, I believe there were about 36 new positions, including 15 administrators. What's the status of those, and what's the role of those administrators?
We are transitioning from a decade of cutting and tightening belts to saying our customers deserve better than us saying we can't afford to do our jobs. So in both of the budget years for which I've been here, we have expanded both our bargaining positions, so operators and mechanics. Building maintenance positions have been a big focus of mine. Everyone deserves to get on at a station, on a busway or a train station, which is painted, where your seat isn't rusted, where you can read the sign and know where you're going. And our team has done amazing work from St. Anne's to Poplar to mowing at Stevenson to improving the lights and adding information screens at the downtown stations. That also implies that we're doing some different things on the management side. So, for instance, last year we added a chief information officer. First time we had somebody pulling all of our IT programs together. That's important to you as a passenger because that's the oversight and the strategy that adds those smart signs out at our subway stations or our other locations where you might be catching a bus. It's the know-how behind getting your fare card to show up on an app on your phone so you don't have to use your smart card anymore. Ultimately, it's Wi-Fi on buses, and it's moving us into a smarter tech future. Other programs have also been focused on BRT and planning. Our planning department dissolved back in 2014 because we weren't doing new things. But if you can't plan for the future, how do you know that what you're doing today is relevant? And again, it's not, it's my money as a taxpayer, but it's not mine individually to invest. And so if we're spending somebody else's money in our community, how can we tell you we're doing something smart with it, right? We added a planning function and we're expanding that so we can plan for the future to do better service today.
Planning for the future, you mentioned to the Confluence and others, the necessity of a long-range plan. We're talking a couple decades, a long-range plan. Where are you on that?
So our long-range plan is so broad in scope that we're going to need some help on that. So we currently have a request for proposals listed to get outside help for this and get a consultant in. So that's listed right now as an active proposal through Port Authority. We are optimistic we can get this awarded and be moving by the winter. And the cornerstone of this is going to be an awful lot of conversations with the folks who are writing us today, business entities that want to have a closer relationship, for instance, pay less for parking and support transit, and all our other decision makers and, you know, various stakeholders all around the area. The focus now is what should transit feel like in 2045? So if you're a patron, how convenient should it be? Should it be overnight? Should it be every 15 minutes in rush hour? Should we have robust programs where employers are subsidizing transit as opposed to parking? You can use it on the weekend. How should it factor into development? When new things open in Hazelwood Green, how early should we be out there? Is it built around that experience? And I'm looking forward to having that conversation of how should transit make you feel, whether you're a commuter or you're a mechanic or you're somebody who's just trying to get from one medical appointment to another. So that's out for bid right now, and we'll be kicking that off in the spring. And we're really, really excited about it.
What's the role of the Port Authority of Allegheny County when it comes to the new study of downtown streets that's being led by the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership?
We are working extremely closely with the Downtown Partnership. Like many streetcar systems or legacy systems, our downtown activity is a holdover from when people caught all their streetcar lines and they made all these connections. So we don't have one hub. We have a lot of really, really busy bus stops and intersections. Folks aren't making that many transfers necessarily, but every bus pretty much is running through downtown. And I love waving at our employees. I love waving at buses. If I'm waving at eight buses in a row, I have to think it's time to talk about should all eight be on that stretch of Sixth Avenue. Again, I'll wave at them all day long, but does everyone want to get to Sixth Avenue? And as we're looking at downtown as our community's living room and neighborhood, what's the right blend of buses getting through town so folks make easy connections versus buses maybe circling around a block on the edge of downtown so folks can connect, but those buses don't contribute to the congestion and they can turn around and get back on their schedule faster. Mm-hmm. So we're working very closely with the Downtown Partnership on what that should look like, what works for passengers and what works for business owners and for people attending different events who might not be on a bus, might be on a train, but they're still navigating downtown. So how do we all make it a better place to be?
Are you advocating for limiting or restricting certain streets, not allowing private vehicles on them?
That is a conversation that we have had with our friends at the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure over at the city. Clearly, buses can go faster when they are not sharing traffic with other vehicles. But I think that's a broader discussion of where do pedestrians go, where do bikes go, and what are the functions that downtown streets should be serving.
In May, the Port Authority Board approved a three-year contract with a London-based software company to let customers pay for rides via a mobile app. It's supposed to be available next year, any kind of ticket, single fare, annual pass. How's that coming along?
Oh, great, great question. Another exciting thing to talk about. So this is our mobile app. It's one of our initiatives to make it easier for folks to pay. We are still looking at piloting potentially by the end of this year on buses and on our rail vehicles by next summer. So we have a a really great working group with our union and our administrative personnel talking about what's the impact for somebody's daily commute from the worker side. And what does that mean for a patron? They can download an app. They can tie it to a credit card or a prepaid card like you get at a Rite Aid or a dollar store. And then you just scan your phone when you get on the vehicle. And it's coming. And we're very excited about it.
Whether it's the new BRT or partnering with other agencies or the new smartphone app, how do you think the public feels about the Port Authority now? As an agency, not historically the most beloved.
Certainly, you must be kidding. We have done a couple of different things to talk directly to customers. So clearly we have customer service and folks can call up. They can email. We have a whole team of folks that just do social media. We go to an awful lot of meetings and I routinely have people recognize me when we get on the bus or on the train and they're like, hey, you're the CEO, which is a great time for them to give me an earful. And surprisingly, people they say thanks for being here, or we love what's going on with Port Authority, which is a testament to the fact that we have an amazing team. I mean, even before I got here, nearly 200,000 people a day are on buses. 200,000 people a day can't be wrong. So it's less an issue of rehabilitating and more of making sure that the good work going on can connect with customers. We do a Voice of the Customer survey, and we did our first one last year in June. We've recently completed the second round, and the group of folks who answered were pretty different from Survey A to Survey B, so we're trying to connect the dots to make sure we make good sense of it. You know, and what did people tell us? They said they thought we were pretty reliable. They perceived us to be about as on time as we were. They asked us to have cleaner buses, but we had pretty good scores. We also participate in a national benchmarking group for train performance, and interestingly, we have the highest safety ratings of any of these groups participating. So our patrons say they feel safer on Port Authority trains than anywhere else. These wonderful interviews are great, but if our individual passenger doesn't think they're having a better experience, that's the job.
Not all those conversations, they say, hey, you're the CEO, can be that rosy. Give me an idea of something that maybe somebody suggested and you said, it really got you thinking. You say, yeah, we could do that.
The suggestions that we get from folks that we can't do, things like, why don't you have a subway under Oakland? Why don't you have 18 hours a day of service in the North Hills? Those are the harder conversations to have because people will say to us, you know, I want your service. I just don't have enough of it. I'm too far away. I rarely have people getting into conversations about services, icky or services. Mostly it's people asking for more of our service. I'll tell you, I get a lot more. We get feedback from operators on how we can be safer. Can we add blue lights in the buses to cut down on glare on the windshield, which we've just added, we're piloting. So these conversations turn into a lot of really good content.
Any additional goals for this fall, the next months ahead?
Wow, we did a tactical plan last year, which we have recently wrapped up. And at our October and November committee meetings, we'll be briefing our board about how we've done. And we've achieved an awful lot of those goals. The first one was create an excellent customer experience. Second was create a safety culture, create a financially stable operating plan, just codifying what we're doing, creating a culture of employee engagement, and improving communications with all of our stakeholders. So look forward to that update, and that'll pave the groundwork for a 5-year strategic plan. We had to do the smaller plan to get ready for the bigger plan, so we'd have realistic expectations, and it gave us a time to reboot these conversations in the past 2 years. So I look for, in November, our new schedules, and we are starting to consolidate some of our stops so our buses can run faster. It's also got an air quality impact, and just continuing to be a great part of the best community in America. That's what we're doing.
Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, he created the artwork for hundreds of albums for such music icons as the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan, and many others. A conversation with artist John Van Hammersveld, whose exhibit, The Era of Cool, is featured at the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.